Well, thanks for coming. This is an exciting opportunity for me. I really like explaining what we do and what quantum information is to teachers and getting feedback as well. Don't hesitate to interrupt and ask questions or ask me to explain stuff. I can do it either during the lecture or after the lecture is fine as well. So I want to essentially describe what quantum computers are, what quantum teleportation is, and what quantum cryptography is. So it's essentially an informative lecture. Quantum information, one way to describe its origins is at the interface between physics and computation. They're usually taught as two separate subjects, right? You have computer science classes and computer programming classes and physics classes, but they're actually very strongly linked together. Because information, whatever that is stored in some physical medium and manipulated by some physical process. So you can't really have a theory of information, a theory of computation, independent of the laws of physics. It's the laws of physics that really tell us what's possible and what isn't. And the classical computers that we have today, their design, the model that was derived, was essentially inspired by classical physics, Newtonian physics. If you look at the model itself, what Turing and whatever was describing, you don't need any quantum theory for that. It's purely classical, which is good because we can actually control classical systems, and classical physics is a good approximation, but it's not a perfect approximation. It's wrong or at the very least incomplete, and we have a much more powerful framework for physics, quantum mechanics. So we have to ask the question, does this change information science at all? The answer could be no, but it doesn't seem to be. And so why is this an interesting question? One reason is we're building smaller and smaller computers because we want them to be faster. We want them to be smaller. And we're very quickly approaching the regime where each bit of information is stored in just a small number of atoms. So then classical physics will not be a good approximation, will not be sufficient for the people trying to build these computers. They have to know about quantum mechanics. On the left here, you didn't need to know any quantum theory. In the middle, you probably have to know quite a bit of quantum theory. But at the right end, where we're heading, it's going to be a very quantum regime. And we're approaching that regime exponentially fast. There was Gordon Moore, former chairman of Intel, ages ago, noticed that every 18 months, the number of processors per square inch of a chip was doubling, right? And it was just continuing. And of course, he had about 3 or 4 data points, so it seemed like a ridiculous conjecture. But he was right. The trend has continued. And actually, the last time I gave this talk, I just had the chart for up to 2000. And then I updated it this morning. And in fact, it does continue just all the way to today. In fact, it's accelerated a bit recently. But what will happen is, in 10, 20 years, depending who you ask, and I don't mean ask crazy people. I mean, you ask Intel or people in this industry, they'll say, well, we're gonna reach this atomic limit. So how can you get smaller than a couple atoms? Very soon. So at the very least, as we're approaching this limit and try to get the last few doublings, last few clicks of Moore's law, the engineers will probably be your former students or my former students will have to be able to control quantum mechanical systems. We'll have to understand what that even means. But what's really exciting about quantum manipulating and controlling information at the quantum mechanical regime is not just, in fact, being able to keep doubling this, keep speeding things up until we hit this brick wall is just one motivation. But what's really exciting is we can do more than that. It's all the rules change, actually. And we can try and exploit those rules and do things that were previously impossible. We really want to do fundamentally different kind of computation. We didn't build airplanes just so we can taxi along highways faster, right? That's not a good use of airplanes. You want to fly. You want to actually take advantage of the new medium they offer. So this is my simplest, my favorite explanation or like not explanation, example of what quantum mechanics is and why we need quantum mechanics. So we've all seen it in some shape or form. The two-slit experiment is a very popular way to first see it. But I think this is better, especially if you want to try and introduce it to high school students. Not that this is high school ready, though I've given similar things to high school students, but it's my opinion, the closest thing that we can use to teach it as a first course in quantum mechanics. So we have an apparatus where there's a source of photons. In fact, this works with any type of particle, but the smaller, the better. And there's this apparatus called the beam splitter. It's just some sort of piece of glass. It used to be a half-silvered mirror. So a piece of glass is transparent. All the light goes through. A fully silvered mirror will fully reflect all the light. And a half-silvered mirror has less silver than a full-silvered mirror. Sometimes the light goes through. Sometimes it doesn't. Right, so you do this experiment. You send out a particle of light. You can barely see it there. And it'll go one way, or it'll go another. And you accumulate statistics, and it seems to be totally random which way it goes. And you know, if you put just the right amount of silver, it'll split them roughly 50-50, randomly. Okay. Now, you don't need quantum mechanics to explain this. Right? You just say, well, you can sort of explain it in terms of classical randomness. Pick your favorite sort of hand-wavy explanation as to why this should be the case. The mathematics is easy. But when you set up this modified experiment, right, where you set up two half-silvered mirrors. Let's see. Okay. So, is that mouse up there? So this guy will split the photons 50-50. And these are just full mirrors. These are normal mirrors that simply redirect the light, the particles of light, so they arrive at this mirror at the same time, regardless of which path they take. So, in essence, this first part of the experiment is a bit of a red herring, because if the photon comes in this way, it'll get split 50-50. And if the photon comes up this way, it'll get split 50-50. So whatever this stuff does, it's always going to come out 50-50, because you're averaging two probability distributions, each of which are 50-50 distributions. So you're for sure going to get a 50-50 distribution using logical deduction from what we've seen. Right, but do the experiment, right? And don't look at the photon in between to see which path it takes. And what you'll notice is it always comes out one branch. Okay. So this is totally, this makes absolutely no sense. Because if you take the first half of this apparatus apart and you put the laser here, you'll see it goes 50-50. You put it here, it goes 50-50. You study the photons as they go through the mirrors, and they always take either this path or that path. You put it all together, and then nothing makes sense anymore. It comes out 100% there, and it really does. I mean, these are kind of experiments we can hope to show to high school students, at least videos of it. But it'd be nice if someday we could actually have them see it. And we'd like to set up these kind of demos at the IQC in the new building, if we can. So it's real. So the simple explanation of what's going on with these photons and beam splitters is wrong. It's not just a fair coin flip, because there's just no rational way, no plausible way, really. There's implausible ways to try and explain it, very elaborate conspiracies, but there's no simple way you'd believe. We have to generalize the notion of probability. That's what quantum theory does for us. I think in primary or high school education, we see, you know, these probability trees where, you know, we start off, we have an event, and with 50% chance, you have a half probability of going this way or that way. Right? This is modeling which way the photon goes after the first beam splitter. And then after the second beam splitter, it takes another one of two paths. So there's four possible paths, right? And the probability of each path is the probability of the product of the probabilities of taking each branch. So the probability of taking that one path is a half times a half, which is a quarter. And so each of these paths have a probability a quarter of occurring. So if you ask, well, what's the probability of ending up at the zero detector? You can label the detector 0 and 1. It's a quarter plus a quarter, which is a half. And that's how we made, implicitly, that's how we did that prediction. That's why we were expecting a 50-50 distribution. And quantum theory tells us, actually, classical probabilities are the magnitude squared of quantum probability amplitudes. So this quantum notion of probability. And they essentially behave in the same way. You know, the probability amplitude of this path is the probability amplitude of taking that first step times the probability amplitude of taking that second step. Right? So instead of a half, we had square root of a half and so on. Except what are the square roots of a half? Well, there's plus 1 over root 2 and minus 1 over root 2. In fact, we use complex numbers. So there's a whole circle. You know, if you look in the complex plane, there's a lot of square roots of a half. But especially for pedagogical purposes, you don't even need to use complex numbers. So my guess is with high school students, you probably want to start with just keep it real. But you get this weird negative probability. So this path down here, right, it occurs with probability amplitude minus a half. Right? And so what's the probability of getting 1? Well, it's you add up all the quantum probabilities. So it's a half minus a half. Right? So 0 squared. So the probability of that event is 0. And that explains why we never see the photons up. That explains why we never see the photons here, because the probability of that event is 0. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between those probability trees and this explanation of this experiment. So more explicitly, we say this beam splitter, you still have a photon along a path which we're going to call 0. Let me clarify that. So I'm going to call a photon in this path representing the bit 0, and a photon in this trajectory representing the bit 1. So it starts off in 0. Once it goes through the beam splitter, it's in the state 1 with probability amplitude 1 over root 2 and 0 with probability amplitude 1 over root 2. And if it's coming in along the other way, same thing, except there's a minus sign in front of the 1. That's just what the model, that's what the theory, that's what the experiment forces us to model it as. And so when you're trying to explain the full experiment now, start off in the state in the path 0. You go into both paths at the same time with these amplitudes. And then when you do the arithmetic, I mean, you can do this a little more slowly and trace through why, but you get the 0 two different ways, with probability amplitude a half plus a half. You get 0 with probability amplitude 1, and 1 squared is 1. And the 1s cancel out. You get a half minus a half. And it totally explains why we see that in the lab. Now, it's important, like in classical computation information, we're all very familiar with the idea of separating information from the medium storing the information. Right? You take a picture, it's somehow stored in the memory of your camera card, then you upload it to your computer, it's already been translated from one medium to another, onto your computer drive, and then you email it to somebody over these cables, and it gets translated zillions of times between, you know, electrons and photons on different people's computers, and eventually it ends up on someone else's computer who prints it out, and now it's back on a paper medium. But it's the same information. It's just been changing medium. So there's nothing really, you know, this same mathematics can describe a whole host of different physical realizations of this. So, you know, a bit can be a photon in one of two paths, but it can also be an electron in one of two of an atom, in one of two energy orbitals. Right? So here's a cartoon of an atom, nucleus, and the electron could be in this lower energy state, this ground state, or this excited state. So this would be the 0, and this would be the 1. And there is an equivalent to the beam splitter. There's a physical process that'll do the same thing that the beam splitter does to the photon. Right? So you shine some light on it. Right? There's an energy gap between these two orbitals. And you know, if you shine light of that energy on it for the right duration, 0 will get driven to 1. And 1 would get driven back to the 0 state. But if you shine that light for half the time, you get this weird 0 plus 1 superposition. And if you try to look at that atom, if you try to look at the electron and say, well, which orbital are you in? 50% of the time it'll say I'm in the ground state, and 50% of the time it'll say I'm in the excited state. And again, you could have this theory that says, oh, it's just random, right? But it's not, because we shine that same light again, and we deterministically will get back down to the ground state, right? So there's no classical randomness here, because if it was randomly in one or the other, we'd get some kind of random output at the end. But we don't. We get a deterministic output. So, and this is exactly the same mathematics as I just showed you in the photon experiment, but with atoms. And there's, you know, hosts and hosts of different, you know, the experimentalists these days, they do these, they have these rings of electrons called squids, where you have 10 to the 9, I think on the order of 10 to the 9 electrons in a ring, and they either are all going that way, or they're all going this way. So it's a macroscopic thing, and they can actually get a superposition of these two events. So with some amplitude, all the electrons are going that way, with some amplitude, all the electrons are going this the other way. Right? It's amazing. That's like a huge
thing. Can I ask you to do a unit test? You have a question?
And they're getting better and better at manipulating these two things. Now, these kinds of superpositions are much easier to manipulate than those right now. But people are also manipulating these macroscopic things, too. So what quantum mechanics is a new I'm a mathematician, actually, by training. It's a new mathematical framework. Right? Mathematics is the language of physics. Right? And what we really realized at the beginning of the 20th century is that the language we were using just wasn't powerful enough to explain physics. You couldn't do physics in just that language. We needed to make it a little more powerful, allow these superpositions, introduce matrices and so on as the fundamental objects describing reality. Right? So it's a new framework. Like we went from an old flat Earth framework for the universe to a round Earth to even more sophisticated. But this is just an analogy. But it's really a new framework, and it's not just, oh, I now understand how atoms work. We really had to change the underlying language in which we did physics. So the bottom line is, when you say, okay, so what does quantum mechanics, does it change information in information processing? It does, in very fundamental ways. And the bottom line, I think, is that any physical medium capable of representing a zero or a one can represent a linear combination of zero and one. So you can have zero, which is complex, but again, you can even you can get the full power of quantum theory with just real numbers. It's a little bit trickier at times, but it's probably worth it in the beginning. But see, complex combination of zero and one. Now, what really stumps people is they can understand the mathematics because we're honestly just multiplying 2x2 matrices and 4x4 matrices. So there's nothing beyond high school there. But it's just explaining what that actually means. It's really tough, right? But as Feynman put it, it's a mystery. And he was talking about the interference fringes they saw in the two-slit experiment. He said, well, it's a mystery, the mystery of quantum mechanics. We don't understand it, but we can tell you how it works. So we know how this all works. We can make predictions, but there's a huge, you know, if you ask 10 people, what does that mean? You'll get at least 12 different answers. So my point is don't try to obsess. Don't say, oh, I'm going to first understand that, and then I'm going to go on. Right? Because honestly, most of us don't understand how computers work in detail, right? I couldn't build a computer. I don't really understand, you know. But I use it all the time. So that's kind of what my suggestion is with quantum mechanics. Get enough of an understanding for how it works, and then do something with it. So it's not just about photons or electrons. You could have superpositions of, so any two distinguishable states, or more, there's nothing wrong, it doesn't have to be two, but two is the minimum. If you have two distinguishable states, can be in both of those states at the same time. So these are the spins. This is if you saw the NMR lab, they're talking about the spin state of nuclei, spin 1/2 particles being up or down, but or being up and down at the same time. Right? And it generalizes to everything, including the whole universe. Okay? And this is one of the things we work on here at the Perimeter Institute. What does it mean for the whole universe to be quantum mechanical? Right? And you know, this is a Schrodinger cat thing. So here's an atom, it could be up or down, and if it's up, the cat dies, if it's down, the cat lives. So you get these weird things, superpositions of cats being dead and alive. If you think cats are big, well, the entire solar system and so on is, if you look at the mathematics, and superpositions of different configurations. Right. And this is all very mysterious, and people are trying to make sense of it. And again, there isn't a lot of consensus on the right way to approach this. I mean, I have my own personal preferences. I'm quite fine with quantum mechanics and what it predicts. Other people keeps them up at night. But And we've gone, really important to note is, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, we were doing experiments. I mean, there were other puzzles too. Like, why is an atom stable? We didn't understand that. People thought it was just, we'll figure it out. But what we needed to do was invent new mathematics. We needed quantum theory to explain why atoms are stable. So there was also some sort of theoretical arguments suggesting we needed quantum theory, and then experiments also showed things that couldn't be explained with classical theory, and then suddenly quantum theory could explain these phenomena that we observed. But now we're beyond just observing quantum phenomena. Now we're the ones sort of saying, okay, I have my photon here, and I'm going to make it do this and prepare this superposition and make my electrons do that. We're really getting better and better at controlling quantum mechanical systems. I mean, atomic clocks, all that is, they're cesium atoms. There's two. The way time is defined now is in terms of the energy gap between two certain energies of a cesium atom. So a second is so many oscillations of between two energy levels of a cesium atom. So they trap cesium atoms and they let them evolve, and everything's compared to this rate of oscillation. That's how. I mean, it's a bit hairy. I have to really sit down and think about exactly how it works. But it all relates to this oscillation between these two quantum levels of a cesium atom. And this is how time's been defined for a long time now. And there's people that they can measure a second with precision, 10 to the minus 15 now, 10 to the minus 15th of a second. And it's because of these atomic clocks. So we're getting really good at controlling quantum.
To extend the quota because you need a jump.
And why is that interesting? Well, one of the reasons me as a mathematician or theoretical computer science think it's interesting, it's that it allows us, it sort of challenges the implicit premises of the whole theory and model of computation. This is Alan Turing, who is one of the, founders of modern computer science. That was a supervisor church. Their thesis was that any computer that's sufficiently powerful can simulate any other computer. Like a PC can simulate a Mac can simulate a PC. Anything with that's sufficiently complex, sufficiently intelligent, can just, in the simulation, the idea is simple. You just, as long as my computer is capable of storing the description of a Mac, like the logical specification of each of these computers is very small and finite. So as long as I know how your computer works, I'll just simulate the mechanics of your computer, and yours will simulate mine. So there'll be a bit of a simulation overhead, but generally speaking, the overhead is not a lot. So if a problem is hard on my computer, it's hard on your computer. If it's easy on your computer, it's easy on my computer. Using very crude measurement of hard and easy. Of course, mine might take 11 seconds, and yours might take 100 seconds, might be 10 times faster. But essentially, there'll be this fixed constant as to how they scale. Mine will always be 10 times slower or faster than yours. But apart from these slight differences, they're essentially equally powerful. But all of this presumes classical physics. Because a classical computer system can simulate another simple classical system. But there's no general purpose way for a classical computer, these computers we have today, to simulate quantum mechanics. And we assume certain problems. See, for modern cryptography, like when you use SSH or SSL or HTTPS, secure online transactions or whatever, they're using cryptography, which relies on the difficulty of some mathematical problems. Right? It's because we really believe that this computer will take a million years to solve those problems. Right? But a quantum computer can do it in a very small number of steps. We don't have large quantum computers yet. We have small ones that you would have seen at IQC earlier. Right? So what's so hard about it? Give me three quantum bits. I can, by some sequence of laser pulses and interactions, prepare linear combinations of all 8 configurations. Right? And if I have 4 quantum bits, I have 16 configurations. Right? And 20, I have a million configurations, and so on. With even just 100 quantum particles, classical computers can't simulate them. So there does seem to be this extra power in quantum computers. They're very good at simulating themselves. And what we work on as computer scientists is, well, what else, what other problems can they solve that classical computers can't? So this is sort of a physical cartoon of what a quantum computer looks like. But computer scientists, we work with an even more abstract model where we start with our input, we apply certain logical gates, just like we do in classical computer science, and then look at the answer. And this is powerful because, you know, here we can physically prepare a linear combination of all the inputs. And then we can evaluate some function once and get a linear combination of all the answers. So on a classical computer, I would have to compute f at 1, f at 2, f at 3, f at all, f at 2 to the n, right, exponential amount of work to try and simulate this state here on the right. But a quantum computer just kind of does it automatically for free. Now, I don't get all the information, so I've done, you know, exponentially less work. I do have less information, but I still, because I can't get all the outputs, because if I look at this, what happens? What if I were to just look at this state? What would I get? I would get one of the answers with probability alpha. I get f at x with probability alpha x squared. That's what quantum mechanics tells us. So I'll just get one of the answers at random. So we have to do something a little more sophisticated, but we can interfere these different outcomes and get various global properties of f, of this function. And this is what allows us to break a lot of these crypto systems in use today. So the applications of this quantum parallelism, well, there's several that we know of. The simplest one to explain is, as I've already mentioned, is factoring. It's easy to take two large numbers, p and q, and multiply them to get some number n. But if I were to give you n and say, what are the prime factors, it'll take you ages on a classical computer to solve that. If n is but 1,000 bits long, you won't be able to do it using any known, currently known algorithm. There's another mathematical problem people use as well, but let's just stick with factoring. So classically, the number of steps it takes, the number of multiplications it takes to factor an n-digit number is exponential in the cube root of n. So e, this is, looks a bit scary, but basically it grows really fast, this function. For n equal to 1,000, it's just astronomical in size. Whereas on a quantum computer, I just need on the order of n multiplications of n numbers. So if n is 1,000, it's no big deal to multiply 1,000, 1,000 digit numbers on a classical computer anyway. But once we have quantum computers with sufficiently fast clock speeds, it shouldn't, we expect, be a problem to crack these systems, to factor large numbers. I'll fast forward through this because I think it'll get us back on track. There's other algorithms, other problems we know how to solve with quantum computers. For example, simulating quantum mechanical systems. Physicists today, you know, if you tell them, okay, if I put these 100 atoms in a box, and really simple atoms, and we know all the dynamics, we know everything, which isn't true, but even if we did, and I said, okay, and if I waited 10 minutes, you know, what would be the probability that I'd find an atom here? So mathematically, I can set up all the equations and say, well, you just have to compute this, right? Of course, to compute that on a classical computer would take you all the computers on, you know, you would, the lifetime of the solar system, it would take you billions of years. Like, you wouldn't have time to do it. It's just too many, because 2 to the 100 is a really big number. So you wouldn't have time to do that computation. But a quantum computer could efficiently do the simulation. If you explain the dynamics of a quantum system, it'll be able to simulate them and make these kind of predictions for you. And basically what we do at the IQ, one of the main agendas of the IQC is to figure out what are the powers and capabilities and limitations, because we know they can't solve certain problems, but we're trying to find problems they can solve, and so we can know what they'll be good for in the future. But we already have a list of things we know they're good for. So that's all I'll say for now about quantum computing, but I'm happy to answer questions now or later. I want to move on to another quantum technology. But before I do that, I want to explain a simple quantum quantum property, which is called entanglement. This is how some people they'll tell you this is the crux of quantum theory. I don't think so. I think they're all intrinsically related to each other, but this is definitely an important consequence of quantum mechanics and its entanglement. if you give me two quantum bits, so you can have one photon or one atom or whatever described by a linear combination of 0 and 1 over here, and you give me another one that's described by, you know, alpha 2, 0 plus beta 2, 1. Now, suppose I want to describe it as a joint system. So the way you glue them together mathematically is you say, well, I have 0, 0 with probability amplitude alpha 1 times alpha 2, right? And I have 1, 0 with probability amplitude beta 1 times alpha 2, right? And so on. It's the most natural, simple way to do this. This is exactly what you would do if I flip two coins, and the first one gives me 0 with probability alpha 1, and the second one gives me 0 with probability, heads with probability alpha 1, and the other one gives me heads with probability alpha 2. The probability of getting heads is alpha 1 times alpha 2. Like, this is a completely natural, I couldn't think of another more natural, or even as natural way to describe the joint system. And this is the way it works in quantum theory. Now, if these two quantum bits interact, their joint state can often evolve into superpositions that cannot be factorized. So it's possible to take two atoms and let them evolve so that they'll either both be in the ground state or both be in the excited state. So 0, 1, and 1, 0 have amplitude 0. They never happen. So you get this thing. Except it's a much richer kind of correlation. This resembles a simple classical correlation, where you and I have the same bit, but we don't know what. Right? Like where I flip a coin, don't look at it, copy it, put it in an envelope, and we take them far apart. So we both, if you wanted to model that using classical probability theory, you'd say, well, with 50% probability, we both have 0, and with 50% probability, we both have 1. Except this is a much richer kind of correlation, which I don't really have time to explain today, but you can do experiments which produce results which cannot be simulated by a classical world. Right? And this is how people in the 70s and so on actually tested quantum mechanics. These Bell inequality violations. There are certain, they said, look, in any realistic classical, local classical universe, you should not get a correlation above this amount. And then you did the experiment, but quantum mechanics lets you be this correlated. And they did experiments and they achieved these kind of level of correlation. So they said, look, your classical explanations won't work. But this is something we see a lot of in quantum information. And I'm going to show you an example of what it's good for. This is EPR pair after Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. They actually, these were all Gedanken experiments. They were just, thought experiments. They were trying to actually ridicule or just sort of say how ridiculous quantum theory was. Because if quantum theory is correct, then it should be possible to create these kinds of particles, which have these properties, and that's just ludicrous. But they do. I mean, they've created these particles, and they have those properties. They're also called Bell pairs after John Bell, who actually was the one who said, look, who came up with these experiments and said, well, some people think these things exist, some people think they don't. Well, if they don't exist, then these are statistics you should get, and if they do exist, these are the statistics you should get. And then later, people did the experiments and verified that, indeed, the world's quantum mechanical. In physics, you can't really prove anything, right? There's always a sufficiently complex conspiracy theory that says, well, actually, it's another way. So mathematicians often have a hard time with that. So physicists say they proved, but they didn't prove anything. I mean, just verified stuff to several, strong degree of confidence. So this is entangled because, again, you can't factorize it into an alpha 1. You can't factorize it into a state that looks like two qubits that look like that. And this is actually an easy exercise even for high school students to prove why you can't factorize it. It's an easy exercise that should prove that this is entangled. So a simple application of entanglement is quantum teleportation. So I'll have this cartoon set up, this animation to take us through all the steps of quantum teleportation. The important thing to remember is we're teleporting information. We're not teleporting the medium, we're teleporting the information. So a mathematical identity, which will be useful, is to say Well, if you give me an EPR pair and a qubit in an arbitrary state. It's hard to appreciate teleportation because all it without appreciating quantum information, because all it really achieves is the communication of quantum information via classical channels, which is baffling. But if you don't know what quantum information is or think that it's worth anything, then who cares? But once we appreciate that being able to shuttle quantum information around reliably is a valuable resource, then you can really appreciate the power of quantum teleportation. So here's a qubit in an arbitrary state, tensor product, and EPR pair. So you can actually rewrite this, expand and recollect and recombine factor stuff to look like this, where I have with probability amplitude a half, I have an EPR pair, tensor, that qubit. Or probability amplitude a half, I have a modified EPR pair. This is another bell pair, basically, with a minus sign. It still has essentially all the same properties as the original guy, but as a minus sign. Tensor, your original qubit, but with a minus sign there. So you just have to put a minus sign in front of the one to go back and forth between these two. Or this other slightly modified bell pair with your original qubit, but 0 and 1 are flipped. So it's almost the right answer, just 0 and 1 are flipped. Or lastly, with probability amplitude a half, this other modified bell pair with the original qubit, like the alpha and beta are still there. And it's really easy to decode the original qubit from this one. I just have to flip 0 and 1 and put a minus sign in there. So it starts off on the left, but in some weird way, it's on the right. But it's entangled with these bell states. And if you do the linear algebra, if you just expand this guy, treat this like variables and whatever, and expand it, you can verify this identity. Question is, who cares, right? Is this something mathematicians think is cute? Is it good for anything? Well, let me tell you what it's good for. Suppose I start off with two qubits. Right here, I'm using atoms. Usually, people talk about photons, but I'm trying to be different here. So you can have two zeros. Encoded in the ground state of these atoms. I can, by an appropriate sequence of pulses, laser pulses, and interactions between these two atoms, they can create one of these EPR pairs. So this has been done. These guys that are really good with atomic clocks can do this, and they've done this. Okay, that's nice. Now I can drag these two things arbitrarily far apart. And they'll still be described as 0, 0. They'll still be entangled. You'll still have an EPR pair if you have a perfect quantum channel, one that doesn't interact with your atoms. And now they've done this not over very long distances yet. They've just done it on the order of microns, maybe millimeters even, in their labs. But in principle, you could take these atoms miles apart. And photons, they have taken miles apart. So we've done it miles apart, like on the order of tens of 60 miles apart, tens of miles apart with photons. With atoms, it's a bit harder, but it's possible in theory, right? And so one could be taken to Alice's lab and the other one to Bob's lab, and they could be in different parts of the city. Someone else could have done it and brought them each one half of these EPR pairs. So now they share this funny kind of quantum correlation, and it's generic. There's no specific information encoded here. It's just 0, 0 plus 1, 1. Everybody can know that that's what it is. Now suppose Alice has some quantum bit she needs to send to Bob, right? And suppose now they don't have a quantum channel between them anymore, right? Maybe they exchanged this at a party last night, but today now they don't have a quantum. I mean, quantum channels are very fragile things. They don't just come around every day. So they don't have a quantum channel anymore. But she wants to send him this bit. So remember, we have this qubit here describing this qubit. This state here is describing these two. Right? So together, they look like that. If you treat this as a 3-bit system, which happens to be spread out over space. Right? So again, with that mathematical identity I showed you earlier, we know it looks like this. It can also mathematically be described as this crazy superposition. Why is that interesting? Well, Alice can locally, just in her lab alone, can apply some laser pulses and interactions and translate those four entangled states into these states, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. That's a perfectly kosher quantum transformation. And again, people can do these kinds of things. So here's a question for you. If Alice were to look at her electrons, right? Look at this one and look at this one. Look at this one to see if it's 0 or 1. Look at this one to see if it's 0 or 1. What's the probability that she'll see 1, 0, say? So Bob doesn't do anything. He's oblivious. But Alice sets up some apparatus to look at the electrons. In fact, you can even ignore, a hint is ignore Bob's state. Just pretend it was the superposition here. Sorry. No? Because then, Right. Because you have to square the amplitude. And then it works, right? Because so you get this with probability of half squared, which is a quarter, plus a quarter, plus a quarter, plus a quarter. So whatever this probability is, you put absolute value signs and square it, and that's the probability of that event occurring. So when she measures this, her system, she will, some people like to use the term collapse. I don't like that term, but for pedagogical purposes, it can be handy. It kind of collapses into the state 1, 0. That's what she sees. And that event will occur with probability of quarter. So she looks at it, and I can sort of explain how one would look at an electron, but it's just this technical detail, to see if it's in the ground state or the excited state. And then it will become one of those four configurations, right? And then Bob's system will collapse to whatever it... Basically, we're going to collapse to one of these four situations. Bob doesn't have to do anything. Alice did the collapsing for him. It sort of seems like a non-local thing, which some people find spooky. So you end up with this state for all three of those bits with probability 25%. So what has just happened? Okay, so it's just not doing anything here. This is describing the three-bit system. So again, 1 and 0 is describing Alice's bits. Alpha 0 plus beta 1 is describing Bob's bits. So Alice and Bob haven't talked to each other. All they did was they were sharing these EPR states, which had no alphas or betas in them. Alice had created this alpha 0 plus beta 1 state in her lab. She did this stuff and measurement in her lab. And suddenly Bob's sitting there with this state in the state alpha 1 plus beta 0. He's never heard of alpha and beta before, right? No, this is nothing. No one's done anything in his lab. But suddenly he's got this sort of scrambled up version of the state that Alice chose. Could have been miles, light years away. He's almost got the state Alice wanted to send him. What's missing? He knows, because in advance they knew what the protocol was, he knows he either has the state itself, the state with a minus sign extra, the state with 0 and 1 flipped, or the state with 0 and 1 flipped and a minus sign extra. So there's four possible perturbations if you treat the identity as a trivial perturbation. So all Alice has to do is send him two bits of information to tell him which of those four events occurred at her end. Right, so she can write it down on papyrus. It can be classical technology. There's nothing quantum here. She just writes, she looks, she knows what she got. She writes the answer down. She sends that information over to Bob. She can broadcast it. She can do whatever she likes, basically. Just as long as that information gets to him. It doesn't have to be a quantum channel. It doesn't have to be a private channel. As long as once he gets the rumor as to which of the four outcomes she got, he knows what he needs to do to correct his state and get the state that Alice wanted to send him. So let me look at, this is the way it was originally drawn and conceived by people. Source of entangled particles, those were the two atoms I drew, but originally people were thinking photons, because it's much easier to prepare entangled photons, right? So we got to rotate this picture 90 degrees. So Bob's lab is on the right, and Alice and Charlie's lab, let's say, is on the left. Then Alice takes the qubit psi, which is our alpha 0 plus beta 1, combines it with her half of the entangled state, does this Bell state measurement, which is the measurement I described, and communicates those two bits to Bob. Conditioned on those two bits, Bob will do some transformation, which will reproduce Alice's state psi here. So psi here, and suddenly, after this transformation, it reappears here. And that's mysterious for many reasons. Some people like to say, well, how the heck, it was a quantum state, it remained quantum, how did it somehow get sent through a classical channel? One way of conceiving it is as a sort of travel backwards in time through this Bell pair. So a lot of people like to think of it as a sort of backwards time travel, which may or may not be a useful way of looking at it, but it is an interesting way to think of it. But I like to just look at it in a practical terms. It's a way of, this is like a classical channel. It's not a very, you can't communicate quantum information with it. But if you augment it with one of these entangled particles, you can turn it into a perfect quantum channel. And that's what teleportation is all about. And it's more of a primitive than an end in itself. Like, why would you want to send quantum bits around? But it can be useful for many different things. This could be miles apart, or it could be trying to communicate quantum information from, if you're trying to build a quantum computer, we need to get information, we got to shuffle information around these quantum computer chips. And they are building quantum computers on chips. These Atom Trapper guys, sorry, their recent generation experiments are on these, they look like chips. And they trap atoms on these chips. And they need to drag the atoms around the chips to get them to interact with each other. And dragging an atom around is a bit of a pain on a chip. So one idea is to teleport information around the chip. Sort of generically create this entanglement and then use that to teleport information. Because it's easier to move two classical bits of information from one side of a chip to another. That's easy. We've been doing that for decades now. We're getting better and better at it. Whereas dragging an atom, storing a quantum bit around without messing it up is hard. So that one potential and likely application of quantum teleportation is in the construction of quantum computers. But it also can be useful for long-distance quantum communication and quantum cryptography. Try and... let me finish. So about quantum teleportation. Quantum teleportation has been implemented since the late 90s. The first two experiments were in Rome and in Vienna, but it's being done all around the world. Gregor Weiss, the lab you visited at IQC, he's done quantum teleportations. Some of the nicest examples we've seen lately are they actually teleport information across the Danube in between Vienna and, maybe the Czech Republic or something. But these experiments have been going on for 8 years now, these quantum teleportations. They've almost all been using photons. So you entangle two photons, you measure. It's hard to do Bell measurements with photons, so these have all sort of been imperfect teleportations. One was done in NMR, which is less exciting because it's all within a test tube and a big magnet. It's not across the river Danube. And recently, the ion trap guys have teleported this internal state of ions from one part of their ion trap to another part. So, which is useful, again, for building quantum computers. So these are for real. It started off in the 80s as just this crazy idea. And now in the early 21st century, it's being done all around the world. It's not easy. And there's several groups that can do this and do this. The last quantum technology I want to touch upon is quantum cryptography. Now, I think you've already had some sort of explanation or demonstration at the IQC on this. Okay, good, because I'm going to give sort of a very brief, high-level explanation of what's going on. Another property of quantum mechanics, which we often hear about, this sort of Heisenberg uncertainty principle, is what it's really saying is quantum mechanics provides another way of looking at it is as intrinsic eavesdropper detection. Right? Because if an eavesdropper tries to look at your quantum bit, if you extract information about the state of your quantum bit, you have to disturb the quantum bit. If you try to extract one property of the quantum particle, you must randomize another property of the quantum particle. So that, see, in other words, you can't extract information without messing up the system to some extent. And it's quantifiable. I extract this much information, I must disturb this the system this much. And it's guaranteed by the laws of physics. One consequence of this is this no cloning theorem. If Alice has one, if you have one copy of a quantum state, you don't know what it is, but you possess it, you can't copy it. Because if you could perfectly copy it, you could make a lot of copies, measure it, and you could, with high precision, arbitrary precision, determine all the properties of the system if you could copy it. And that violates the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So you can't copy, and we can mathematically prove why you can't copy or clone systems, which can be a useful property for information security, right? Here's some, I have information stored here. Anybody who tries to snoop, copy, whatever, will mess things up. So there's a fundamental and quantifiable trade-off between information extraction and disturbance, and for cryptography and information security, this is a very, very powerful primitive. It's not an end in itself, but it can be applied to give you this sort of what people call unbreakable cryptography. And the idea is very simple. Again, it's the cryptography that's unbreakable. It's like having a lock on the door that can't be picked. It doesn't mean I can't kick the door down or take the door off the hinges. So there's a difference between the cryptography and the information security system in which it's applied. So we can make that, at least that little component is unbreakable. How it's used, we have to watch as well. But at least that part you won't have to worry about, as long as you believe quantum mechanics. The idea is quite simple. Alice wants to communicate with Bob, wants to share some random information with Bob. She'll prepare a bunch of quantum bits, send them over to Bob. She can even give them to the enemy to take over to Bob. And if the enemy promises not to look at it, not to touch it, right? And you say, okay. And the enemy, she either does or doesn't, right? If she does look at it, she will have disturbed the information. And then Alice and Bob, and then when Bob measures the bits and communicates publicly, it doesn't have to be secret, with Alice, he'll say, well, what was bit 1,000 supposed to be? One. Oh, okay. So you sacrifice a tiny negligible proportion of your bits just to see if anybody had tampered with them. And if they did, you'll notice it, and you'll reject. You won't pay, you know, the mailman or whatever. And if they didn't, well, you'll know it, and then you now share random bits. Like a major objective of cryptography, when you're doing HTTP, you know, secure HTTP, they establish these session keys, which are essentially random strings that the two ends, that your computer and the other, you know, the Amazon's computer share, to encrypt your credit card number and stuff. But they're random. They can be anything, as long as they're random and no one else knows what they are. So that's the point of quantum key distribution, is to establish random keys, or to expand random keys into bigger ones. And the idea, again, is simple. If I were to just pick a random key and send it to you over the internet, I have no idea if somebody's snooping and knows the key. But if it's encoded in quantum medium, if somebody snoops, looks at it, they will disturb it, and we can tell. So the idea is quite simple. Just send it and check to see if anybody looked at it. And this has been implemented since the early 90s. Right? And we're getting physicists around the world, and including here. So I guess they've told you at IQC that we're setting up experiments to go from the IQC building. Actually, we're going to put a light source on top of one of the engineering buildings, which will send one photon to the IQC and one photon to the fourth floor here to implement a certain type of quantum key distribution. Other implementations have been in, you know, the European mountains here. This is, I forget where this is. I think this might be Austria or Vienna. This might be England. I can't remember. Some European city. This is in the streets of Vienna. They've also implemented, like, this is Alice and Bob. No, this is Bob and Alice. The technology is fundamentally light. So this is the apparatus, which I guess you didn't see yesterday, but there's a laser which outputs light and gets put through these beam splitters here. And part of the beam gets sent to one Well, there's different setups. One is Alice has a laser, Bob has a detector, and sometimes you put the source in the middle and Alice and Bob both have detectors. There's different setups. That's why I'm speaking about it at a high level. But there's simple versions of it that are, the mathematics is very accessible to high school students if you're interested in trying to do that. So countries around the world, England, Europe, Canada, United States, Los Alamos National Labs, many groups around the world are doing longer and longer distance quantum key distribution. They're all with photons because they're the natural thing to use to communicate. And these in the mountains and in this city here, they're sending the photons through the air. And that works. In other places, they're sending them in optical fibers buried under the ground. So there's two different media. So qubits are stored in photons of varying wavelengths, and they're either sent through the air or through a fiber. So there's a whole host of different implementations of quantum key distribution going on around the world. Gregor Weiss's system will be with free space photons. But we plan to team up with other colleagues around the world try and get the free space system working with the fiber-based systems. So I've listed three types of quantum technologies. Then the three main ones, the main ones are quantum computing, and quantum communication, and quantum cryptography. So I've tried to tell you a little bit about that. The key question we always get is, well, when are these available? And some of them are available now, like quantum or random number generators, which are just, prepare a superposition of 0 and 1 and measure it, and that's a random bit, which are useful, which are necessary for many protocols. Quantum key distribution, there's definitely prototypes in universities and research labs around the world today. You can even buy them today if you want. So I would think within 10 years, in terms of actually integrating them and using them, this is available as soon as we want it, quantum key distribution. Quantum teleportation works, but it doesn't work with a high enough fidelity. It's not fast and cheap and easy enough yet to be selling quantum teleporters at Costco or whatever. Small-scale quantum computers we already have. Slightly bigger ones, say medium-scale ones that we would need in a quantum communication network are attainable, I would say, in the next 10 to 15, 20 years easily if we want them. In large-scale quantum computers, it's much harder to predict. But my guess is as we move along, we'll have greater and greater confidence in when we'll get them and what the right technologies are. Again, quantum crypto, a few years ago, it was ranked by as one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world by MIT Review. These are some of the devices you can buy. This is a Swiss company that sells these devices. This is their random number generator. And there's another American company that also sells the devices. And there's other labs that are actually producing prototypes but aren't selling them yet. So in conclusion, the points I wanted to... a lot of this stuff is preaching to the choir. Quantum mechanics is for real, and we all know that, but it's something that the greater society has no clue about. And it redefines information processing in very important ways. It was quite conceivable that, despite the fact that we totally revamped the whole framework for physics, that it didn't change what was computable, it doesn't change what's computable. What's efficiently computable might not have changed. Cryptography might not have changed. But that's not what happened. They both changed very dramatically. These large-scale quantum computers that we want to build, they seem possible. We have small ones. We have up to 12 qubits here at Waterloo. That's the world record. And there's strategies for building dozens of them that even skeptics don't doubt we'll get. But building the large ones is a huge technological and physical challenge. But top researchers, Nobel laureates around the world are stepping up to that challenge and making amazing progress. And there's already prototypes for quantum cryptography that are being done in different media all around the world over long distances and already for sale. by some companies. And another, I think, neat thing is that a lot of the basics are accessible to high school students. So I think there's certainly ways of packaging a lot of this stuff and getting high school students excited about physics, making them aware of the fact that there is this quantum mechanics, quantum information, and actually getting their hands dirty with it. So thanks for your attention.